Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 44, where Ralph, Tom, Greta and Pedro are discussing transaction cost theory of the firm. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now, back to the conversation. If you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion where the podcasters reflect on the text, discuss implications and areas for further research. And now, part 3 of episode 44.
All right. So this, in part 3, we've been discussing the implications and the connection to other scholarship and the prior parts of the two these two articles. I'm going to try that again because that was terrible. Okay. We've been discussing the summary of the Williamson and Malone articles in part 1. In part 2, we've been discussing its connection to other research in organization and management science. And in this part, we're going to go into some more detail about the topics they didn't discuss and what we think the lessons learned are of Williamson's seminal article, The Economics of Organization, the Transaction Cost Approach, and Malone and colleagues' article, Electronic Markets and Electronic Hierarchies. They both make some very persuasive and easy to verify claims, since we have the benefit of 30 years of hindsight since they wrote it, but there's things that we think aren't exactly predicted by their theories. And I know Tom's got one he wants to lead with, so take it away, Tom.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with one of the conclusions that they had, and I believe it was one that we mentioned earlier, number 4 on Malone's page 496. All of the firms should consider whether more of the activities they currently perform internally could be performed less expensively by outside suppliers coordinated by computer-based systems. Sounded absolutely wonderful if, you know, in the days when the internet was kind of a new thing. You know, and I remember seeing this because, you know, again, going back to my artificial intelligence days in the 90s, the internet was this wide open space of wonderfulness. It was going to solve so many things as the internet flourished. Firms were starting up and, you know, a lot of activity, but there was an incredible amount of trust that was placed in the growth of the internet. And unfortunately, of course, it didn't take very long for people to start taking the opportunity to do illicit activities over the internet.
Right. And exploiting that trust, right? Exploiting that lack of security because as you were noting, the internet was designed with openness in mind, right? Maximum amount of openness because, of course, people are well behaved and human nature as we know it isn't going to cause any problems, but maybe then again it does.
The onset of viruses and I want to say this was, you know, predominantly around 1993, which was about the time when viruses started to become a concern. You did have folks in the in this growing information security field who were, you know, they were basically crying that this was a problem. It was falling on deaf ears until the real economic impact started to come to the fore. Obviously, this is not something that Malone could have predicted. But nowadays, it really is kind of interesting to see how information assurance concerns are sort of going in conflict with the openness of the internet. And how do you balance the two, especially when it comes to where you're drawing the firm boundaries? Because the forces that are at play, the economic forces at play, suggest that if you're going to be in the economic field, that you want to disperse, you know, you want to diffuse your organization as much as possible. But on the other hand, control of information is vital, especially when we're talking about the control of information of a personal nature. And you're talking about, you know, computer break-ins that steal millions upon millions of health records or personal information that can be used for, you know, basically to steal identities. And so I'm just kind of curious what you all think as the impacts of that on what, you know, where we've come in the past 30 years since Malone and where we think it's going to be taking us in terms of how do we reassert the boundary and try to restore the proper control over information that the firm is touching.
So one of the things that occurred to me was this, the idea that reading the Malone article, these authors seem to be making the assumption that knowledge and information, you know, those are all, those are just good things. And they don't address really how it flows, who it flows to, and then how it can be misused. The Williamson article does talk about people who have, you know, they bargain for advantage and they're always, well, they may not bargain in good faith is basically the way I took that. But they don't really, they don't, he doesn't develop that very far. He just talks a little bit about that. And so the kernel of the idea is there. And I think, but I think that it's really not addressed at all in the Malone article or the Malone colleagues article. And so my personal view is that they're going to have to rethink the internet and information systems design to now realize that there's a certain kind of information, which I don't think could have been imagined by these authors, so I'm not really blaming them. But there's certain kinds of information you don't want freely floating around, that we do have to create some boundaries for how it's managed. And we're doing it now, but there are still aspects, all of these things, what occurs to me is all of these things are band-aids or add-ons to what's already there in the web, as opposed to designing the system with security and managing information flows in mind. And one of the things that people get frustrated with working in the United States for a Department of Defense firm, but I think the same thing occurs in the Ministry of Defense in England and in Brazil and Holland, these, you know, similar kinds of issues where certain kinds of information have to be kept away from people who could then use it to expose vulnerabilities, either in your economy or your military forces, is that the systems that you use inside these kind of protected or assets or islands or whatever you want to call them, necessarily have to develop and evolve more slowly than the other systems do, because security is the first thing they care about. Now, they don't necessarily always execute it well, but it is one of those things they care a lot about. That's my view, is that they're going to have to rethink how we use that information and how that knowledge is used.
Yeah, let's also point out that these threats are not necessarily external. Internal threats is also part of the concern, and we've seen that in some of the recent breaches or the embarrassing situation that Sony faced. I believe it was it wasn't too long ago, where, you know, the insider threat was what. You had somebody on the inside of the organization who enabled.
Oh yeah, that's
right. Emails,
yeah, exactly. Emails got hacked.
It's not the traditional boundary kind of a thing where the enemy's on the outside. The enemy's definitely on the inside on this one.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Actually, that some of the biggest breaches have actually been internal actors, and so you think to yourself, okay, well, I have these firewalls and I have these protocols for keeping some people, you know, externally at bay. But the nature of what you have to do when your biggest risk is an internal agent, oh my gosh, that really complicates things.
So building on this dichotomy, I think I want to tackle another dichotomy, which is this very idea of marketing hierarchy. So just a few things before I get there. We have been discussing how, and I can imagine that in the beginning when, you know, we have these new kind of new technologies, actually at the beginning of the internet, there is, I'm sure, this very strong idea that is going to be something very open, that is going to allow for so many things. And of course, as Tom very well was saying, that, you know, we had the virus and all the kind of problems and the way people use the tool unexpected and all the problems that came from that. I think it's interesting because the Malone article has this very kind of old school, so to speak, idea that it's almost hitting at the idea that the market is great, and the more we are going to use technology, the more we're going to be open, the less we're going to need hierarchy, the more things are going to be just, you know, freely circulated, integrated out there. And we know that it's not necessarily like that. And I think it's a case that we can, it's good, I think it's a case in which it's productive to think how actually regulation, control, and all this kind of issues which we tend to see necessarily as negative can actually be very important. Actually, it makes me think that this dichotomy doesn't help so much, because in a way, what they talk about under the umbrella of hierarchy, which is just about governance and control, it still has a very important role to play as you have a bigger market, as you have more integration, you know. I will give an example. We were thinking about internet, but nowadays there's a lot of technological development from Raspberry Pis to drones to all kind of new gadgets and all kind of new things and smart cities and putting, you know, like chips in all kind of new daily kind of tools. But I don't see a lot of concern, and that concerns me, of how we're going to regulate and make sure that all these different kinds of new gadgets are going to be overseen, you know, that are going to be concerned not only for creating new technology, but also to look at the possible implications and regulate all that.
Yeah. If you think about that, so a lot of the things that are now causing us difficulty because of all the information flows would have traditionally been below the radar of regulators. And so the example I'm thinking about is, I think it was a baby monitor or some kind of video monitor that was sold in just huge numbers, you know, quantities, but somebody found a vulnerability in that thing and used it to hijack all these monitors or have them behave badly, you know, other things. And traditionally, this is not something a regulator would pay any attention to.
I would say, like, I disagree that there's no attention to regulation. I think we have been through a period where we experiment with the opportunities that digital technologies offer us and the openness. But now, especially like with Cambridge Analytica and like how Facebook data has been used in kind of changing the dynamics of elections, we start to become aware regulation is definitely needed. We need to have some oversight, some governance, or what Tom said, like the control of information and the control of data and making sure it's being used for good purposes. And when we move towards more market-based models, we get confronted, and especially policymakers and regulators get confronted with new questions they never had to deal with before, in how can they start to develop policies, regulations to control information, control data, which first was the responsibility of firms.
Right. So there was no need for the regulation. And I completely agree with Greta, because that's where I was going, was that you know, it's one thing to say, oh, the market just takes care of all this stuff. But I have the same skepticism that Pedro does, that we're seeing that, no, it doesn't actually. And so I actually remember a few years ago when the European Union was talking about the, you know, putting legislation in effect, which is strongly criticized the United States about this right to be forgotten, you know, but I think it opens up a really interesting issue about who does own that digital information that's you online, and what is to be done with it. And I also think that would be interesting research to do. Is not just where all that is, but some of these ideas about the role that regulators have, but also where regulation and privacy and innovation and entrepreneurial spirit, where do those things all cross? And I think there's a lot of data that suggests it's hard to manage innovation, it's hard to manage entrepreneurship. But I really like what you said, Greta, which was, well, we got to really think about what. Are there standards? Are there policies? Are there, you know, are the ways we want to think about that? Because you can't just say, well, it's all moving too fast, so we really can't do anything, because we're discovering that that doesn't work out so
well. And then the question comes to mind, like, is regulation a responsibility of one stakeholder in a field? For instance, when you talk about, like, data protection on the internet, or is it a shared responsibility? And if it's shared, like for instance between Facebook and the government, how are you then gonna operationalize? How do you gonna design for that? So when it's not inside the boundary, it's not outside the boundary, but it's cross boundary.
Yeah, I think that kind of allows us to turn some of the discussions on the theories of the firm on its head in a way, because if you think about it, one of the issues that organization exists is exactly to deal and to make sure and to accomplish more reliable, precise, effective kind of work, you know, to have accountability, to have make sure that tasks are done a certain way. So, and it's kind of the link that is missing in these articles and also in the overall discussion that has a more economist kind of, you know, even Carnegie Mellon kind of tradition and also some other parts of organizational theories, which is exactly how works get done. So how works is a central part of the existence and the goals of organizations and how organizations are set up to make certain tasks possible. So I studied the aerospace industry, and I think that's a great example to think about regulation because, you know, it's a case that, of course, we want innovation. Of course, we want to have, you know, it has suppliers from all across the world and everything's very complex. And at the same time, however, has to do a very kind of, you know, reliable product. And there is a lot of regulation. And it's a great case on how regulation is very much perceived to be also an insight issue. So the whole idea that there is hierarchy, there is governance, there is just the market outside kind of gets a bit more blurred and overlapped because it's a kind of market in which is so reliable that you have to have governance even for processes that are outside the firm, so to speak. And at the same time, we are trying to integrate from inside. So it shows that this dichotomy can not be helpful always when you, you know, are dealing with more complex tasks, at least.
Right. So one of the things that comes to my mind is in the US, and I'm sure they have the same thing in UK and other countries in Europe, they have these pretty strict rules on how you can share health data, right? So here's a pretty good example of you have different organizations within an industry or a field, in this case, the healthcare field, that need to share data because they have been outsourced and they do exist independently of each other, but they have the need to share information. So one of the things you have to do in the United States when you need healthcare is besides going to the facility, you have to sign a bunch of forms that give you guidance or tell you what the protections are for how they share your information and share it with other providers, because it can be used to deny you insurance and all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of negative aspects to this. But I think it goes to the heart of what you're talking about, Peter, which is, okay, was that all internal to the firm, how that gets regulated, or what's the method for managing this information that has to be shared because of the nature of what has been outsourced and the boundaries that we basically drawn today, and then how the information gets used, not only how it gets shared, but then how it gets used.
Well, also, when it comes to regulation, it's how much of that information can be consumed. As you're talking about those types of forms, Ralph, I was thinking about all of these other agreements that we get exposed to. Licensing agreements, information sharing agreements, or what have you, that are basically individuals are expected to agree to in order to receive a particular service. And yet, you know, for the most part, either they just sign the form or they have the form put in front of them and they just are basically told, sign here. Okay, I'll sign here. You see what I mean?
Right. Otherwise, you can't go any further. That'd be a great study to do, is like, who has any clue what's in their end user license agreement?
Exactly.
Right? I have no idea. And I signed about 500 of them.
Yeah. And so that that kind of makes me think about, you know, the organization essentially exercising another form of control, And then there's also another aspect in which we can think about this issue of information, and that is its own inherent reliability. I know we were talking about information being either stolen or improperly accessed, but what if the information is simply wrong in the first place, or has been tampered with, not by criminals, but say folks who are trying to manipulate information in order to make themselves look good or bad, or make others look bad. And I'm talking about a thing. I'll name Yelp only because it's the company that I'm thinking about. But it's just, think about the different types of information services you might be dependent upon in order to understand what options you have for when you're traveling or you're in an unfamiliar place or what have you. And then you kind of rely on the 5-star ratings, And, you know, the firm itself has a great interest in trying to project a proper, you know, an image. Five-star ratings are a great thing for them because they presume that it means that they will get more customers. But they don't necessarily have any say-so whatsoever over some of the things that, you know, how people enter information into those types of services. And so you could end up with somebody who's just plugging your firm with one-star ratings because they can. I don't know how else to put it.
Yes, I kind of lost my track of thought thinking along with you, Tom. And I was also thinking from the other side, and I was thinking about reputation. I was thinking about identity. And, like, for instance, when you think about, like, where would you look 10 years ago or 15 years ago if you wanted to go to a really good restaurant? Probably you would know, like, I have to check these two research, for instance, like the amount of Michelin stars or something. I think there's something similar in the US. And now with the emergence of all these types of platforms like Yelp, like TripAdvisor, you have like Google reviews, you have Facebook reviews. It kind of becomes the responsibility of us as individuals to check all these things and be aware of them and be critical about them to assess like the truthfulness of the information and form our own judgment.
What does this do to our notion of transaction costs, kind of bringing this back to the Williamson? I mean, are we basically explaining or describing new forms of cost that change the way in which we think about the transaction cost model?
Well, I think in some ways, right, because the transaction costs of putting a dumb idea out on the internet are about zero now. So whether it's fake news or misleading, think people trying to mislead elections, or having these really strange reviews on Yelp or TripAdvisor or you know something like that, it's amazing to me that in fact what it does is it complicates your job, right? I mean, I actually there are days when I long for to just have the Michelin book so I can see how many stars somebody had to make a choice after that, because now what you have to do is read through all these reviews and then decide, okay, how much that's noise, how much somebody was having a bad day or they were trying to hold somebody hostage for getting a free dessert, you know, what are some of those things going on? And I'm not sure that in all ways it's made everything better. And the other example I'm thinking about, I think there's research could be done not only on that, where there's just all this noise out there, but I've seen goes back to information design and trying to you know reduce information transactional costs. I've seen internal programs or applications that are designed in such a way that actually makes the person's work harder because, or at least as they understood it, because somebody, either the software engineer or the person that gave the software engineer the specifications, has reimagined the nature of the work. And then people are given these software tools and told, okay, go, here you go. You have this new tool where all the things they used to be able to do, they can't do anymore. And what we learned in the Department of Defense was, okay, you can go to these companies like SAP and Oracle and say, okay, well, I want to customize so I can do this, and I can do that, and I can do this. Well, that just makes your cost skyrocket because now they have to do all these customized things. And then, oh, by the way, they're going to rev the software in a year or two, and none of your fixes will work anymore. So, it's a big challenge for these things. I think in some ways it's weaponizing software. I get very frustrated sometimes about that.
So I wanted to just go back to the whole idea of Michelin guides, old school versus Yelp, because if you think about the Malone article, it's very much, you know, going back, it's very much in an information processing perspective in which the problem is getting the information. But nowadays we have a world in which we have all kinds of information. We are overloaded by it. So I think then becomes the dichotomy of hierarchy and market becomes more problematic, to go back to what I was saying before, because then you kind of need ways to organize all this information that in part can be I mean, we can say hierarchy, but I'm meaning here very much kind of, you know, governance structures, kind of, you know, ways that, you know, is going to impose some order in something that before there was this idea, oh, it's just like a very indifferentiated space. We need some differentiation in order to kind of, you know, deal with it. So the dichotomy kind of, again, I think, crumbles.
I completely agree. And I would suggest that instead of seeing it as a dichotomy, maybe there are two extremes of a continuum. And we moved, like, maybe when you think about, like, going back in time, the Industrial Revolution, where we saw the emergence of lots of firms, and now in the digital transformations we're going through, we see a lot of experimentation with market-based models. We start to realize the limitations and the risks and the open questions of these market-based models. And we see the need of governance. We see the need of oversight, of regulation. And maybe there is a role for hierarchy to play at a market level. But because we never use the market to such an extent, maybe we have questions about what that would look like. And Pedro, I want to challenge you a bit in like this kind of key argument of Malone, that kind of they're talking about, like, when things are more complex, more specific, you need more integration, you need close communication, you need close control and close coordination. And that's why hierarchies existed in the first place. And I'm thinking about bureaucracy. And they kind of say, like, well, we can get rid of that because information technologies can do that now, or digital technologies, maybe algorithms or automation. And then that happens at a market level instead of at a firm level. So, Pedro, what is your take on that? Like, do you really think, like, bureaucracy is we don't need it anymore? And the opposite, if we think about the role that bureaucracy plays in organizations, what could it play at a market level?
I would say it would be a very sad word if bureaucracy didn't exist. So, at least for me, because I need, you know, I need to keep studying it. That's my new topic. I mean, that's my topic. So that's interesting. So I think there are two things. I think the first is exactly what you're saying. There's a historic aspect. We tend to be very present heavy sometimes. And, you know, we tend to think that the things that we're seeing in the past year is going to be forever, but we know that history is not like that. And we know that things go, as you're saying, you know, different models come and go. So I don't think that just because we have online labor markets and we have it for all kinds of work, then it's going to necessarily mean that the old school organization has ended. Because think about it, if you go, there are still very large, very integrated kind of organizations. They might not be in some industries, they might not be in some places, but, you know, I usually say Walmart is a great example of a very important large firm, very traditional, that is very big player in the economy. We have Silicon Valley, but we also have places like Walmart. And in Silicon Valley, Google is a, you know, you can spin it however you want as a very fancy, different, wonderful workplace, but I'm sure there is still records, there are still procedures, there is still hierarchy in places in the Silicon Valley. So, you know, it's a matter of what we decide to look. So what kind of companies we're interested in looking, and then it creates kind of, you know, an effect that we think that's the only one that exists. What aspects we decide to look in certain companies, and then we think, of course, you know, now NASA does open innovation. There's a wonderful work by Hila that from NYU Stern that has, you know, shown how NASA has incorporated open innovation. But it doesn't mean that all the traditional ways and the departmentalization, the division of labor, so on and so forth, is going to completely crumble. Everything is going to be done. There is still going to be a role for orchestrators, at least. And then there is this aspect that you were hitting at as well, that I believe that it is how the very market, so how the very exchange is going to happen, if they become so complex, if they're going to involve so much information, we are going to need formal structures to put, you know, some kind of limits of some kinds of ways to deal with that. So it might not be bureaucracy is understood like an organizational form, but a kind of formalization of some kind of these transactions, depending on the kind of issues to be discussed.
Yeah, I was doing this thought process in my head about like how our images of bureaucracy so derived from the industrial age, thinking about like manufacturing and bureaucracy in these type of companies. And when you think about like the changing nature of work, like we've seen like not all the work is production work. We also have like a lot of service work, consultancy. When you think about like all the work that has become digitized, remote work, like where are the images of bureaucracy when the type of work is less visible? And is it just that we lack understanding of what bureaucracy looks like?
Well, I think it's also the nature of the work, right? You mentioned that the nature of the work is changing, right? And so in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, it was about control. It was about, you know, getting workers to do what you wanted them to and that sort of thing. And those models don't really apply, as both you and I, you know, not, I wouldn't say they don't apply at all, but they're less applicable where the role of management or bureaucracy is about coordination and making sure that people get the information that they need to do their job.
And if I can, I would say that a lot of what we're discussing exemplifies shifts in the private sector, public sector organizations. I for all of the talk of trying to make public sector organizations behave more like the marketplace, there are certain things that public sector organizations do that the private sector doesn't, and that has to do with legal authorities and the legal management of public resources. Regardless of the type of government, whether it's democracy or total authoritarianism, it's just a different beast. And so the more that the private sector moves away, the harder it's going to be for the private and public spheres to be able to intersect. I think we have seen that. And certainly there's been a lot of outreach between on both sides, because the more complex things get, you know, the regulation arm, you know, regulation is going to have to come into play. Well, how does that happen? When you're talking about different languages, so it's an ongoing conversation, no question.
Tim, do you even think that when you look back, it was the economists that started to theorize about the boundaries of the firm? Is it then our role as organizational theories to start to think about how can we explain or theorize about the boundaries of the market?
Okay. I think we can use that as a good good conclusion.
Yes.
So thinking about like Gary Davis' book, The End of the American Corporation, all these speculations, like what is the future of firms? I believe there's a role to play by firms. And I think actually we start to see as the dynamics of these market-based models become more clear, there is a role and a need for more organizing, let's put it like that. And whatever that looks like, firm-like models might provide a lot of insight to help solve or address the problems we're seeing in the market.
Yeah, if you think about it, you know, the economists and the whole idea of the theory of the firm has the contract as the building block of the transactions. And in a way, we can say that the contract is not enough when we have, again, to go back to what you were saying, all this information, these teams of people that are working on that same project. It's just not a matter of, you know, spelling things out in a contract. And it's interesting, I think the work of Melissa Valentine from Stanford looks at that exactly, how organizational structures are actually put in place in large distributed projects. You know, you have roles, you have some hierarchy and so on and so forth. So how the contract as a one-to-one, very individual kind of structure is not enough. And to organize.
No. In fact, it's like an implied contract, right? There's these implications that are out there. I mean, one of the implied contracts of an Uber driver is you don't have a boss. You can work as much as many hours as you want. You have all this flexibility, and so we've gone beyond these hard copy paper one-to-one contracts to more of a distributed way of thinking about the work, which I think is interesting.
So I think that, this issue that you bring, Greg, very much kind of captures what we have been trying to make sense of. You know, it's interesting how we took a question that was emerged from a more kind of ontological question, the nature of the firm, how it exists in the first place. And eventually, organizational theory has helped to flesh it out. And I think the changes that we have been discussing here get us to exactly to that point in which all the things that we have learned by exploring them empirically can help us think how not only firms, but actually the very market can be structured in a different way as we have these new requirements, as we have these new challenges. And to go back to what you were saying about the images of bureaucracy, because of course I have to go to my favorite topic as a main takeaway, we don't know how it's going to look like, but I think that what we're going to happen is that we might not have even if we don't have anymore the kind of old school organizational form, like the bureaucratic firm, I'm sure many of the principles that have helped us to coordinate complex work across different space and time and units and people and, create all the things that organizations can do are going to still stay in complex market relationships. You know, as we are going to have projects that are done through and coordinated by intermediaries, we are going to get to a point that we are going to need formal structures or any kind of structure to kind of shape that and accomplish work in a specific way with some reliability, within some limits, and so on and so forth.
So that's our conclusion. We've come full circle. So we talked about transaction costs. We talked about information flow and outsourcing and where all those things are going and all the predictions that Wilhelmina made. But we've come back to Pedro's and mine too. I share his love of bureaucracy and talking about how the people are going to make the difference, though. And I want to thank Greta for coming up with these articles, because I would never have thought to read these things, and yet it was a wonderful exploration of bureaucracy and organization, which is what our podcast is all about, by starting out looking at information and transactions.
And that's all for episode 44. Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, if you like this episode in particular, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students about the podcast, give us your feedback, or just simply get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, or our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. You can also subscribe to our newsletter on the website. Next week, we are delighted to bring you a conversation with a special guest, Mariana Fotaki, where we discuss whistleblowers, here on Talking About Organizations.